Ladies and gentlemen, this is Kim Greenhouse with It's Rainmaking Time. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's show. I am a huge proponent of life extension and a big advocate of the Life Extension Foundation, which is one of the world's largest organizations dedicated to finding scientific methods for addressing disease, aging, and death. It's a nonprofit group out of Florida that funds pioneering scientific research aimed at achieving an indefinitely extended healthy human lifespan. The fruits of this research are used to develop novel disease prevention and treatment protocols. Stephen Joyelle, MD, is the Vice President of Science and Medical Affairs at Life Extension, and which is the world's leading organization dedicated to extending healthy human lifespan. And for 5 years, he's been a featured speaker at anti-aging conferences worldwide. For example, his recent series of lectures at the Asia Anti-Aging Conference in Bali in 2007 featured mechanisms of aging and top-line strategies with a focus on nutraceuticals for mitochondrial dysfunction, glycation, free radical stress, hormone balance phase 1 and 2, and detoxification. He's a graduate of Dartmouth Brown Program for Medical Education and board certified as an internal medicine doctor in 1997. He also has an undergraduate degree in physics. He's published peer-reviewed scientific journals and health and wellness periodicals for the general public, including the New England Journal of Medicine, Current Drug Targets, CNS and Neurological Disorders, and Arthritis and Rheumatism. He's the author of What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Diabetes, published in 2006. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Dr. Stephen Joyelle to It's Rainmaking Time. Welcome, sir.
Great to be here.
I really appreciate you being here because this is a subject that is providing so much excitement in the world at the prospect of advancing the life cycle and extending it with supplements and nutraceuticals and herbs. And yet at the same time, I know that there are huge legal challenges, challenges with the FDA, challenges with new laws and regulations that are also in parallel running in contrast to the work you're doing. Share with us whatever's in your heart to talk about today about your work at the Life Extension Foundation and some of the exciting things you're finding and the challenging things you're going through.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about our organization. Life Extension has been around for 30 years. In 2010, we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary. We are really passionate about finding new strategies for people to employ to help them live healthier and longer. We embrace a translational approach, and what that means is we take from basic science, whether it's in nutrition, biology, physiology, biochemistry, and we really incorporate that into strategies used in allopathic medicine, naturopathic medicine, just a whole variety of different strategies and technologies that we think are useful. Of course, a good part of our focus is nutrition, including nutritional supplementation. We know that nutritional supplementation has a pretty wide variety of advantages. Very important, for example, in people that are currently taking pharmaceutical drugs to control their blood cholesterol levels. We know it's also very important to supplement with something called CoQ10, coenzyme Q10, a very important cofactor in a variety of energy-producing reactions in the body. We know that statin drugs, and that's the class of drugs that is very commonly prescribed to people to lower their cholesterol, we know that those class of drugs also deplete the body of CoQ10. We think that's not a good thing, and we know that from our reliance on the scientific literature, our many discussions with opinion leaders, thought leaders in the scientific community. And as an example of that, we have one of the world's leading experts, Dr. Peter Langstjone, who is on our scientific advisory board. And Dr. Langstjone has published over 80 peer-reviewed scientific publications looking at the value of coenzyme Q10 in helping to support cardiovascular health. So our organization is really about what works, if you will, and we blend together the best of conventional medicine. We've put in nutritional science, cutting-edge technologies in age management medicine, all together really to help support optimal health and hopefully help people live longer.
There's so many supplements that the organization has done research about. Sometimes coming in, I am actually a member of the foundation, and I have my blood work done through your foundation, and I order supplements through it. And sometimes it's hard because it's like going into a store where there's so many choices. How does the public start to narrow down how many to take? I mean, I could take 300 if I wanted to, but how does the public start to focus in on the top 10 or 20 for them?
Well, I mean, we published a number of articles over the years looking at what we think are the top supplements, nutritional supplements that people should take to help support their health. But I guess the way I'd answer your question is it really is very individualized. People have individual concerns, individual needs. And we also know that in the area of nutritional supplementation, there is a great deal of person-to-person variability in terms of how people respond, as well as their own biochemistry. So we know, for example, that it's important for people to have a general vitamin supplement. But we also know beyond that, you know, there are some key areas that we focus on. We focus on mitochondrial health. The mitochondria are the energy powerhouse of the cell. We know with aging, the mitochondria's ability to generate energy tends to fall off. So we know that there are a variety of nutrients that are very important to support mitochondrial function. I'll mention a few of them. Carnitine is one. Carnitine is an amino acid.
Do you mean acetyl L-carnitine or just L-carnitine?
Well, they're both of use, and they have some slightly different benefits. But the acetyl L-carnitine, there are some wonderful studies showing great effects on brain health, including memory. However, L-carnitine is also very good. L-carnitine is an amino acid, and there is some in the diet, although if you're vegetarian, you're not getting L-carnitine. So if you are a vegetarian, supplementation with L-carnitine is very important. L-carnitine is important for cardiac function in particular. There are other components in the diet that are important, or I should say nutrients that are important for mitochondrial function. Alpha-lipoic acid is another very interesting nutrient. Lipoic acid is very important, for example, in helping in one area of the body's function that I'm very interested in, and that is the area of glycation. Now, what glycation is basically a process where the body's proteins tend to break down. If anyone has ever toasted bread or browned a piece of meat, that browning reaction is actually what glycation is all about. And a lot of people are amazed to know that a similar type of reaction occurs in our body. It's of particular consequence in diabetes. Patients with diabetes tend to have accelerated levels of glycation in their body. And that's very important. The reason for that is that it directly correlates to their risk of developing neuropathy, which is a painful damage to the nerves that happens in diabetes, retinopathy, which is damage to the retina, and the retina is very important for vision, eyesight. We also have damage to heart muscle that occurs in diabetes, too. Patients with diabetes are much more likely to have heart disease and heart attacks than people who don't have diabetes. And one of the reasons for that is this phenomena known as glycation. So alpha-lipoic acid helps in that. There's very good data, for example, showing that individuals who have diabetes, who also have painful peripheral nerve damage, neuropathy, and if they supplement with alpha-lipoic acid, their symptoms are much improved, which is, again, to me, pretty fascinating. I mentioned a little bit about CoQ10, coenzyme Q10. That's also very important for mitochondrial function. Again, mitochondria are the energy powerhouses of the cell. Other things that are important, too. We also talk about a variety of other nutrients that are important for mitochondrial function, like benfotiamine. Now, benfotiamine is really a type of B vitamin, if you will. And it's also been shown to be very helpful when people have the phenomenon known as glycation going on. So there are lots of things people can do, but in order to know what's best for you, it's important to really talk to a qualified health professional. People can talk to one of our health advisors. I think the idea of an individualized approach to health really is very, very important. Again, we're all human beings, but we all have unique biochemical differences. And in order to really understand, know what's best for you, it's important to talk to somebody knowledgeable in this area. And then, of course, also get periodic blood testing done. It's amazing. We can find things. You can understand things that are going on in your body. And it's very important, quite frankly, that if you find something early, it's much easier to deal with it than if you find it late. So we really support the idea of at least annually getting a complete blood panel, blood test profile done to try to identify any issues that might be occurring early on. Again, it's much easier to quell something in the early stages than to wait until something has really had an opportunity to take hold. The latter is not an optimal way to approach things.
One of the things I really thought was interesting about having blood work done through the foundation is that the criteria for things is different. For example, because of the massive amounts of money spent on research and studies and double-blind studies, when you look at your levels for hormones or you look at your levels for things, you have a different, almost schematic. You have an advanced criteria. You're not looking at what the FDA said we should take, what amount of E we should take, or how much vitamin D we should take. If we were taking how much vitamin D we were told to take as kids, we would be starving of vitamin D or vitamin D3, for example. So what's interesting is not only that you provide the testing and a qualified health professional, but that the criteria for looking at what is good health in your organization is up-leveled.
I'm glad you raised that point. One thing that we...
I really want you to talk about that because I found that extremely startling, that the hormone panels, the other panels for looking at what is the health barometer are different than just going to a traditional doctor.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you raised that, and it gets to me a core point that we make often, and that is what is normal isn't necessarily optimal. And I think it's a very important concept for people to understand. Just because, for example, one's free testosterone level is in a quote-unquote normal range, that doesn't necessarily mean it's optimal. Not only optimal from a population standpoint for that person as well. An example that I often use is if you went back 50 years and you looked at, let's say it's 1960, we're going to go back in time with our time machine. If you go back to 1960, what was considered normal from a cholesterol standpoint, these days people would be alarmed. And yet, if you went in to see your primary care physician in 1960 and you had a total cholesterol of, let's say, well, 270, 280, your primary care physician would probably look at you and he'd say,
probably call an ambulance.
or would look at you and say, well, this is fine. There's nothing to worry about there. And again, the key thing here is that optimal is very different than a so-called normal range, which is usually based upon population data. And as another example, we know that the population in the United States, for example, there are epidemic levels of obesity. Something else that I'm passionate about, which is we really have to do something to address this health catastrophe that is facing us over the next 20 to 30 years, particularly with kids. We know that...
Isn't that from the food, doctor? Isn't that really from the food and impure water and the fake food that they're eating?
Well, I think it's due to a variety of factors. You're correct. One is this preponderance of high-calorie, nutrient-poor food. Another aspect of this is physical activity levels. Many schools have, for budgetary reasons, have cut physical education programs. kids, when we were kids, we went home, you went outside, or you went down and you played basketball, you did something, you were physically active. Kids these days will come in the house typically and they'll play on the computer. So there are physical factors involved, there are dietary factors, there are just a constellation of issues that are unfortunately resulting in the population being by and large overweight. 3 out of every 5 people are either overweight or obese. And as another example, we're seeing epidemic rates of type 2 diabetes in kids. Now, traditionally, you never saw type 2 or so-called adult-onset diabetes until folks were adults. But we're seeing teenagers, 16, 17-year-olds. And I'm not talking about type 1 diabetes. I'm talking about type 2.
What's the distinction?
And inevitably, well, one of the distinctions, or the distinction, is with type 1, it's viewed as an autoimmune disease. Essentially, your body attacks your pancreas, and it destroys the insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas. With type 2 diabetes, it's characterized by insulin resistance, meaning at the target organ, in the liver, in the muscle cell, even in the fat cell, there's resistance to the effects of insulin. And by and large, this is due to being, guess what, overweight and physically inactive. We know that something around 85% of folks who develop type 2 diabetes are either overweight or obese. And I'll couple that with physical inactivity, and it's quite the recipe for developing metabolic problems.
Going back to the matrix, the vitamin D levels that you've been publishing and writing about are startling. Startling for vitamin D3. Can you explain that to the public? This is huge.
Sure. Vitamin D is something we're really passionate about. One of the things we know is that the recommendations for many, many years as to what is a so-called optimal level of vitamin D were really woefully inadequate. And what we know from doing research, from interacting with thought leaders such as John Cannell, who's a physician, who's president of the Vitamin D Council, we know that for many, many people, their vitamin D levels in their blood, in their serum, are inadequate. Now, we talk about different levels. What we look at is what's an optimal level of 25-hydroxy-D. And it's probably somewhere between 50 and 60 nanograms per milliliter. It may actually be a little bit more than that. However, what's startling is that the vast majority of folks, not only our life extension members, but people in the general public, aren't anywhere close to that range.
And they're taking how many units a day? 5,000 units of D3?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and the answer is it is somewhat individualized, but a basic rule of thumb is that for every 1,000 IU of vitamin D3, also known as cholecalciferol, that 1,000 IU daily ingested will raise one's 25-hydroxy vitamin D level in their blood by about 10 nanograms per ml. So what that suggests is that in order to be up in the normal or the normal range, you need to be at least above 30. So we think having at least 2,000 IU of D3 daily is necessary to get up into at least beyond the deficiency range, which is anywhere under or south of 30 nanograms per milliliter. But in order to get into the optimal range, we know that people need more than 2,000 IU of D3.
That was so startling to me.
You know, there's something else, too. We actually did an analysis of our life extension members who typically are much, much healthier than the general population. And it was remarkable to us. I actually did the analysis, and what the analysis showed was that, amazingly, about 85% of the tests were under 50 nanograms per milliliter. And again, it's amazing because these are people who are proactive, educated about their health, very involved in taking care of themselves, and yet even in that select group of people, our members, our life extension members, the vast majority of them still were not at optimal levels. Now, the good news is that many more of them were at least not in a deficiency range, which is very important, But regardless, to me, it just points out the value of periodic blood testing and also the importance of dosing with a clinically meaningful dose of vitamin D3. A couple other points for your listeners, which is, as one gets older, the body's enzyme system seems to be not as efficient converting that vitamin D3, cholecalciferol, in a supplement into the 25-hydroxy-D level that's measured in the body. There seems to be some difficulty there.
I was going to ask you about an absorption issue. I'm so glad you're mentioning it.
Well, there's been a great deal of speculation about that. There has, for example, been some speculation that the reason that you see a decrease in bioavailability as people get heavier, as they get more and more overweight, if you will, one idea is that the vitamin D, which is a fat-soluble vitamin, is sequestered in fat stores in the body. So it may be that people are absorbing it okay, but it's being sequestered in excess fat stores in the body and therefore is not being reflected in the blood level, the 25-hydroxy-D level in the blood that we test for. There are other ideas as well. People have talked about different types of vitamin D formulations, the difference between cholecalciferol, which is D3, versus ergocalciferol, D2. That's a little controversial. The data suggests, but is not definitive, that cholecalciferol is a better form for supplementation.
Is that D3?
Yes, that's vitamin D3.
Yeah.
The literature suggests that people have more stable levels of vitamin D in their body with cholecalciferol, that's vitamin D3, and also suggests that if one is to stop taking vitamin D3, that the vitamin D levels in the body don't drop off as quickly as if you were taking vitamin D2, which is ergocalciferol. Ergocalciferol is also found naturally in mushrooms, for example. A lot of people aren't aware of that, but you can get D2 in mushrooms.
Interesting. Whatever happened to the fish oils? Are the fish oils still considered the big, important thing to be taking every day?
Well, we feel that omega-3 fatty acid intake, in particular the long-chain omega-3 fatty acids that are found in fish oil, DHA, EPA, these are very, very important for overall health. We know that they're of critical importance for cardiovascular health. There's also some interesting literature looking at the effects of omega-3 fatty acids from fish oils on lipid parameters, in particular triglycerides, as well as metabolic factors, including blood sugar management. So fish oils are wonderful. And there's also evidence, too, as I'm sure you're well aware, and many of your listeners, that the American diet tends to be overloaded with omega-6 fatty acids, whether it's from corn oil, safflower oil, soybean oil even, as opposed to the omega-3 fatty acids, which are so vitally important for health. Probably the optimal ratio of omega-3 fatty acids to omega-6, it shouldn't be any greater than 1:3. So in other words, 3 parts omega-6 to 1 part omega-3. If it creeps above that, it's probably not optimal. And amazingly, most Americans, their diet is overloaded with omega-6 fatty acids, as in a ratio of anywhere from 10 to 15 omega-6 to omega-3. So 10 to 15 to 1, which is just far too much, an excess of omega-6 fatty acids relative to omega-3.
So if I heard you correctly, and I'm not sure I did, you want for omega-3s 3 times the amount than the omega-6s. Is that correct?
It should be no more than, and it's a little confusing, an omega-3 to omega-6 ratio shouldn't be more than 1:3. In other words, if it's 1:10, that's far too much omega-6. A good ratio to strive for is 3 parts omega-6 to 1 part omega-3.
Got it.
And again, the vast majority of people are ingesting 10 or 15 parts omega-6 to only 1 part omega-3, which is just not optimal.
There's three key things I want to ask you about the complexity of the legal scope of challenge that the life extension has. But I want to ask you two more questions about some things that the public really hasn't made distinctions about with regard to vitamin E, for example.
Sure.
There's gamma and there's alpha. Would you explain it to them and lay it out? Because I think everybody's taking the one that they're not supposed to be taking.
Well, you know, vitamin E, we've been interested in vitamin E for many years with good reason. There's some great data on vitamin E, but many people don't understand that there are different components of vitamin E. Technically, vitamin E is defined as alpha-tocopherol, but there's gamma-tocopherol, there's delta-tocopherol, and also there are tocotrienols. And the data on tocotrienols is really wonderful. There was a recent study that came out that showed enormous cardiovascular benefits with tocotrienol consumption. So people need to understand that there are differences. When people talk about vitamin E, be specific, ask, well, do you mean alpha-tocopherol, which is what most people think of with vitamin E, or do you mean gamma-tocopherol? One thing that's important for all of your listeners to understand is that too much vitamin E in the alpha-tocopherol form will tend to displace gamma-tocopherol. That's not a good thing. We know that you need to ingest gamma-tocopherol as well, and there's some very good data showing a variety of health benefits with gamma-tocopherol. So the best strategy is, one, to obtain vitamin E from foods. Why? Because most of the vitamin E in foods, like almonds, is in the gamma form, gamma-tocopherol. Also, it can be difficult obtaining optimal levels of vitamin E alone from food. Other sources include wheat germ oil, for example, is a pretty good source of vitamin E. But supplementation is important, but what people need to understand is they need to pay attention to that supplement. They also need to take gamma-tocopherol along with alpha-tocopherol. And again, the tocotrienols, which unfortunately there hasn't been a lot of attention in either mainstream medicine or certainly the mainstream media around tocotrienols, but we know that tocotrienols have wonderful health benefits. So the best approach is balance, as everything in life, which is alpha-tocopherol, gamma-tocopherol, as well as tocotrienols. That's really the best strategy for vitamin E.
And that's not necessarily what the stores are selling, though. They're selling mixed, and then they're selling alpha, for the most part.
Yeah, again, the most important thing is look at that label, because the label must list, well, what form is the vitamin E? And if it's all alpha-tocopherol, well, I would suggest that a much better strategy is to look for a supplement that includes gamma-tocopherol as well as tocotrienols. Tocotrienols are very important for health, too.
What has happened to B6? Why is it being removed from the market, and why can't you sell it anymore?
Well, B6, there's a particular form called pyridoxamine, and unfortunately, pyridoxamine, for a variety of reasons, which are some complicated, many of which are unfortunate, pyridoxamine, because of its benefits in terms of health, there are pharmaceutical interests that are very focused on this unusual form of vitamin B6. And because of that, there are pharmaceutical interests that have decided to try to patent this form of vitamin B6. And the reason for that is one of the areas that I'm very interested in, and that is glycation. Pyridoxamine is a form of vitamin B6 that's wonderful for inhibiting advanced glycation end products, also known as AGEs. And as I often say, AGEs age you. They age you prematurely. Now, for a while, we were able to offer pyridoxamine to our members. However, because of the way the regulatory environment exists, pyridoxamine has been classified by the FDA in such a way as to prevent it being sold as a supplement. And this raises a number of other issues, too.
It's been on the market since I've been alive.
That's correct. Well,
isn't it considered out there and unpatentable? I mean, it's been out there for at least 50 years.
Well, I like your argument. Unfortunately, the FDA listened to someone else's argument, another pharmaceutical company, quite frankly, that argued to the FDA that pyridoxamine is an investigative new drug, and therefore it was not a supplement.
Can't they do that with everything? Can't they do that with green tea? Can't they do that with the hormones? Can't they do that with every single vitamin, and this just keep going?
Well, I think it's important to understand one thing that we're passionate about as an organization is preserving people's access to nutritional supplements. To your point, we are always active, and we are aware of legislation which really threatens people's right to access, not only of nutritional supplements, but we're also active in looking at access to, for example, experimental drugs that may have life-saving benefits that are just being mired in bureaucracy. We believe, and although there is compassionate use programs in existence, but we believe that people who have very serious illnesses or terminal illnesses, for example, really should have access under a physician's guidance and care with close follow-up to experimental treatments that may actually work. It would be such a tragedy, and this occurs, we know this occurs, where experimental drugs are still in the drug delivery process but are not available for use yet because they're still mired in that process. And there are people that have serious illness that are not allowed access to those medications. And we believe that's wrong. And
I believe it's wrong, too. In fact, I go a little bit further with you in my paradigm, which is that anybody should be able to, when their health is at risk, experiment with anything they want to. If they are being told they're terminal or they do not want to have a certain type of care that is consistently not worked, it should be their free-for-all to do what they are called to do to save their own life. And the tragedy is that's not allowed here.
No, it is a tragedy, and we believe passionately in freedom of information and health freedoms. And I define health freedoms, to your point, which is to be able to have access, again, under appropriate guidelines, under a physician's care with careful monitoring. But people who have life-threatening illnesses should be able to have access to potentially life-saving strategies, whatever they may be. We think that's very important. So again, and our members and our customers know that we're really passionate about preserving access, not only to nutritional supplements, but in other areas as well. And that's a very good one that we've discussed, which is if someone has a life-threatening illness, we think people have the right to access. Some people may disagree with that.
But it doesn't matter because they're not the ones who are going into the grave. The whole paradigm of medicine and the medical institutions of the world have to shift because at the end of the day, people are going to eventually take their lives in their own hands and they're going to listen to their own inner voice and do what's in their best interest to do to stay alive. And so what will happen is if a critical mass of people keep dying because we keep using the same methods on a medical level that aren't working, that serve just the pharmaceutical interest, they're going to just go underground and use what works. And they're going to be willing to experiment. So it's going to happen. The question is how. We have Codex Alimentarius, which I'm sure you're familiar with, that is a international law and statute that is brewing out of Europe to try to make a standardization of everything that is involving supplements and herbs and very dangerous to health freedoms. I'm doing a completely separate show on that. But for example, you had something that you were selling called avocado extract, which had fantastic results working with obese people. People wanted to lose fat. Do you remember that?
That was before my time, but there was a product, the sugar, it's actually a type of sugar called mannoheptulose, which is presumed to be the active ingredient in avocado, this avocado extract. And there is some interesting data going back to the 1960s, particularly in patients who had hypoglycemia, and that is that the mannoheptulose extract seemed to blunt insulin secretion, which, again, if you have hypoglycemia, you certainly don't want your blood sugar to drop even further, which is what insulin does. You know, just segueing off some of the comments you made earlier about Codex, one of the things that I think it's important for people to understand, and it's amazing to me because I see physicians and presumably people that should know better or be better educated, and they say, and I'm going to paraphrase, they'll say, well, dietary supplements aren't regulated by the FDA. They're unregulated, there's no measure of quality. And I listen to this, and it is completely inaccurate. And I want your listeners to know, dietary supplements are regulated by the FDA. They're just not regulated in the same way as drugs. And this gets to the issue of Codex, which is, in Europe, for example, if you go above a certain threshold dosage amount of vitamin C, you can only get that by going to a physician.
I didn't know that.
That's absolutely true.
Are you kidding me?
No, it's absolutely true. And I believe, if I remember correctly, I think it's 500 milligrams is the threshold.
So oh, my
if you
God.
Want above 500 milligrams, you need to go to your physician who then prescribe that. So what we want to see preserved is people's access to nutritional supplements. We're very active in that area. We believe passionately that that's a right. And I will tell you my personal feeling, which is I think that it would be very unlikely in this country. I do think people would rise up and be very upset. It's one thing to take away a freedom. It's another thing to give a freedom when none existed in the first place. And if for whatever reason, there was the possibility, the real possibility of legislation being enacted to really rob people of freedom of access to nutritional supplements, I know that we would see just this huge swell of anger, and appropriately so. Again, that example, people would be, freedom would be taken away that they already had. And I just don't see that happening. But then again, I think we always need to be vigilant and keep on top of the legislation as it exists.
In 2009, you had in your magazine, you have a wonderful magazine that you release every month to members, you had something that says the generic drug ripoff with Eric Braverman, actually, his picture on it. It was the August 2009 version. What is going on with generic drugs? What is the problem?
Well, in a nutshell, it's this, and that is that generic medications, pharmaceuticals, typically are manufactured, and the cost of manufacturing is relatively low, and yet they are sold for a dramatic price increase relative to the cost of manufacturing. Now, we know that branded pharmaceuticals command a premium, and there are a number of reasons for that. One very important reason is that it takes a great deal of money to bring a drug to market. Estimates range anywhere.
20 years?
Well, it's time, but yeah. Then also anywhere from $800 million to up to $1 billion to bring what we call a new chemical entity, a molecule, up through approval, through an NDA approval, which is a new drug application approval. So it's very, very expensive. It's in the interest of a pharmaceutical company, if they're going to expend that kind of resources, that branded product is priced appropriately. But once that branded product goes off patent, other manufacturers of pharmaceuticals have an opportunity to manufacture a generic. But what's pretty startling, a lot of people don't realize, is that although the generics are much less expensive than the branded product, there's still a steep price increase.
Definitely. Definitely.
And it raises really fundamental questions, which we talk about, fairness and honesty, and looking at the fact that, if there are other areas that employ the same kind of strategy, I think people would really be up in arms. But my sense is the reason that there's not as much outrage over this is because of the difference between generics and branded products, branded products are just so much more expensive than generics, the generic looks relatively less expensive. So I think that that's probably one of the reasons why there's not as much controversy about this. But you're right. You know, you're right to point that out. We talk about these things. We're passionate about this. You know, one of our founders, Bill Falloon, has a monthly column, As We See It, and it typically is an opportunity to write about some of these issues. We know as an organization, one of the biggest challenges facing this country is the health economics of medicine, and the fact that people, unfortunately, are using our healthcare system almost as a de facto fallback rather than taking care of themselves, being proactive in their health. The healthcare system, it really will be bankrupted. And it's not just talking about pharmaceutical interests, but that's also what people are doing. People are not taking care of themselves. They need to be more proactive about their health. They need to eat a better diet, get exercise. Nutritional supplementation is a very important, critical strategy to supporting optimal health, and we believe that passionately.
We now know that those that are paying attention and reading and trying to stay as current as they can, that the whole matrix, the entire paradigm related to hormones is very different today than we knew 20 years ago, 25 years ago, even 30 years ago. We have totally different information today. Can you share with the audience a little bit about some of your findings about hormones?
Oh, absolutely. We actually have written a position paper, which if people are interested, they can go on our website, which is www.lef.org. And we have a paper that we devoted to this very topic of bioidentical hormones, in particular bioidentical hormone replacement. And that means using hormones that are chemically, molecularly, exactly the same as your body produces. We know that that offers a much better strategy than hormone replacement with synthetic patented compounds that are available. I think many, many women, for example, are well aware of the disastrous results of the Women's Health Initiative that was published a number of years back, showing that peri- and postmenopausal women who were treated with non-bioidentical hormones, including equine-derived estrogens, that means estrogens that are derived from horses. People are not horses. I know that's fundamental, but a lot of, at least in the pharmaceutical industry, I perhaps they confuse the two, I don't know. But the results of the WHI using these horse-derived estrogens, as well as progestogens that were synthetic, in particular medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is not the same as bioidentical progesterone. The results of the Women's Health Initiative using medroxyprogesterone acetate, as well as horse-derived estrogens, was really disastrous. An increased risk of cardiovascular events, cancers went up, breast cancer went up as well. We know, based upon our review and assessment of the literature, that replacement, if it's indicated in a woman, for example, with so-called bioidentical hormones, whether it's estradiol, estriol, that offers a much better strategy than using these synthetic hormones.
I take progesterone, and I'm so glad I do. I really am glad I take bioidentical progesterone.
Well, progesterone, of course, you are well aware of the benefits of progesterone. We've talked and written about that. We actually, as I said before, drafted a complete position paper on this whole topic, highlighting all of the scientific research in support of natural bioidentical progesterone in contrast to some other synthetic progestogens, such as medroxyprogesterone acetate. When you delve into the literature, it's amazing what you will find. And it's very disturbing to me as a doctor when I see very, very important, influential thought leaders in women's health get up a bit on national programs or in being quoted in major mainstream periodicals as suggesting that bioidentical hormone replacement has no data in support of that strategy. That's absolutely not true. And what I'd suggest to anyone, if they're interested in learning and understanding more about this, go on our website, because we have a complete article that's devoted to this very issue. Point by point, it reviews all of the literature on bioidentical hormones and talks about the findings and many of the studies. What might came as a surprise to some colleagues in conventional medicine, there are actually head-to-head comparison studies that have been done looking at, for example, natural bioidentical progesterone versus medroxyprogesterone acetate. And again, the results of the studies are pretty remarkable and pretty impressive.
Do you think that most doctors look at the results of current studies? Do you really think they look?
Well, sadly, and again, as a physician, I think that there is a heavy pharmaceutical bias, pharmaceutical influence, and this goes all the way to the medical schools. This is seen throughout, for example, continuing medical education. Doctors need to have CME credits to maintain their licenses. And one of the things that really strikes me is the standard of care, or so-called standard of care. There was a paper that was published in a major scientific journal about 2 years ago that talked about standard of care. And what that means is what's accepted to do with a patient if a patient has a particular condition. What was amazing to me was this, was that only 11% of standard of care recommendations are based upon the highest quality of scientific information. Furthermore,
that's terrible.
More than 48% of standard of care recommendations were based upon the lowest level, and the lowest level essentially is what a couple of thought leaders or people who are believed to be influential in that particular area of medicine, what they think. Think about this. That is almost 50% of what is considered to be standard of care in medical practice is based upon what a select group of academics or influential people think is the right thing to do. Is that amazing? I think that's amazing.
It goes on everywhere, though. It goes on everywhere.
It's amazing, but it's also disturbing.
Extremely disturbing. For example, D3, at least this is what I remember reading in one of the articles in your publications recently, that by taking adequate levels of D3 and other things, that you could help your immune system be strong so that you don't catch any of these flus. You don't ever hear that mentioned on the major networks, ever.
Yeah, it's not something that's discussed. It's something that we've looked at. We know the value of vitamin D in helping to support immune function. And there's it's just completely fascinating data that strongly suggests that vitamin D may have protective effects, not only in terms of the immune system, but in a whole variety of different areas. Cardiovascular, of course, most people are aware of bone health.
Do you mean D3?
Vitamin D3, cholecalciferol. That's what's typically ingested in dietary supplement form. But when we talk about mediating biological effects in the body, vitamin D3 or cholecalciferol needs to be converted or metabolized into different things. And the most biologically active form of vitamin D is 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, also known as calcitriol. In order to go from cholecalciferol to calcitriol, you need to go through two steps that are controlled by enzymes as well as hormones. So when we talk about vitamin D, and I'm glad you brought this up, we talk about vitamin D as a supplement. We typically mean vitamin D3, also known as cholecalciferol. But vitamin D in the body, it needs to be converted to 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which is calcidiol, but then 125 undergoes another hydroxylation step. The 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, also known as calcitriol, that's the most potent form of vitamin D. And we know that that form of vitamin D just a whole variety of biological effects. There are nuclear receptors for vitamin D in over 30 different cell types in the body, which to me is remarkable.
So how do we get it? Are you saying we do get it from vitamin D3 and it goes through all these conversions?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. Yeah. One is sunlight, ultraviolet light, ultraviolet B, B as in bear. That spectrum will activate a vitamin D in the skin. But then what happens is the vitamin D that's activated in the skin needs to go to the liver. That's the first step where it's metabolized into the next, I'd say, form of vitamin D. And then it goes to the kidney, where it is further metabolized, technically speaking, it undergoes hydroxylation to form the 1,25-dihydroxy form of vitamin D. And that's the form that's most potent, most active in the body, and the form that's, we believe, responsible for the vast variety of beneficial effects in the body.
Wow. Are you a big proponent of green tea extract?
Green tea has some wonderful benefits, great cell culture study data in a whole variety of different areas, helping to support healthy cell growth and maturation. Green tea also has wonderful effects on the lining of the gastrointestinal tract. There are some great studies, and we've talked about these, many of these over the years. Green tea, I personally ingest a fair amount of green tea. I love green tea. I like coffee too, but I think that green tea as a beverage has more health benefits. A lot of people aren't aware that green tea also contains an amino acid called L-theanine, and it's probably one of the reasons why, as opposed to drinking coffee, when you drink tea, although it does help to promote alertness through caffeine, it tends to also have a balancing effect, and it's probably through L-theanine, which, again, is an amino acid, and it tends to have a calming effect on the central nervous system.
I interviewed Michael Colgan, Dr. Michael Colgan, a few years back for television, and he's a big proponent of whey protein and biologically available whey protein. And I was wondering at the Life Extension Foundation what your take on whey protein is.
Yeah, whey protein, we know that it has a variety of beneficial effects on the immune system. Many people are not aware that there are constituents in whey protein, a high-quality whey protein isolate. And one of the naturally occurring peptides is something called an ACE inhibitor. What's an ACE inhibitor? ACE stands for ACE, angiotensin-converting enzyme. And interestingly enough, ACE inhibitors have nice effects on blood pressure. And the reason I mention this is because there are many studies showing beneficial effects on dairy products, but whey in particular, whey protein, on people with their blood pressure. And the reason for that is because of the presence in whey of naturally occurring ACE inhibitors. You know, whey, I'm sure Dr. Colgan also talked about whey's effects on the immune system. One thing we know, too, as we get older, our bodies tend to not hold on to as much muscle mass as really we need. It's a phenomenon called sarcopenia. There are many factors responsible for it. One is hormonal, but we also know that having a good protein supplement like whey protein can go a long ways to supporting protein metabolism in the body. So whey is terrific for a whole variety of areas. I mean, I take whey protein, I take our product, which is a high-quality whey protein product. I find it's very important for helping to support recovery after I exercise, for example. And there's a lot of great data showing that whey protein is an easily digested, biologically high bioavailable protein that is wonderful for recovery after exercise.
Do you eat a lot of protein, and do you advocate eating a lot of protein from meat sources or fish sources?
I think it's important to have a protein-adequate diet. Too much protein, and we can talk about that a little bit, too much protein tends to have tends to stress the kidneys a bit. If someone has pre-existing kidney disease, it's not a good idea to eat a high-protein diet. Depending upon who you want to believe, anywhere from 15% of the caloric intake should be from protein every day. And I would say it's probably a good thing not to exceed 25, maybe 30% at a higher level. Of course, the whole area of diet and what's the optimal macronutrient ratio, carbohydrate, protein to fat, is always so controversial. But for me personally, I typically stay within a 20 to 25% of my total daily caloric ingestion is with protein. And I like protein from vegetable sources. I think that's an underutilized, underappreciated protein source, particularly legumes. I will eat low-fat dairy. Low-fat yogurt is wonderful. It also has beneficial bacteria for your gastrointestinal tract. I love fatty fish like salmon. Why? Because the fish oils, of course, we know are so beneficial and so helpful for cardiovascular function. So my diet typically is with fish, low-fat dairy, and I also eat a fair amount of protein from vegetable sources, including legumes, basically beans.
The Life Extension Foundation also has a pharmacy now. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, we have a pharmacy on site in Fort Lauderdale. The pharmacy was really generated, or we wanted to have a pharmacy, because many of our members and customers, we often heard them complain that pricing on pharmaceutical products was very high. We are very competitive in terms of our pricing, particularly with generics. And so we really offered that pharmacy as just another commitment to customer service for our members, so that a member could ask us or inquire about what supplements he or she should use to support their health. And if they did need pharmaceutical drugs for any condition, that we also had the ability to offer them that option as well. It was really for convenience, but also to highlight, too, the fact that, you know, we're very competitive in terms of our prices on generics.
Have you ever found that you've had to deal with battles, or the organization has had to deal with battles with the FDA?
Yeah, I will say since I've been here, I've really been the beneficiary of what's occurred in the past 15, 20 years ago, where our owners really battled with the FDA. The FDA shut them down at one point. And to my knowledge as an organization, Life Extension is the only organization that successfully battled back against the FDA and won. The lawsuit was dismissed. We believe passionately in freedom of information. That's what we're always going to continue to do. And we want to preserve people's right of access, not only for supplements, but we talked earlier about cutting-edge treatments. We're always active in that area, and I'm very proud to be part of an organization that's so focused on the area of preserving people's freedoms, freedom of information. To me, that is fundamental as Americans, and you know, our organization is really at the forefront of that. And we battled back and won against the FDA.
I think it's extraordinary. And I also think that part of the reason for the battle is that your paradigm and what you're doing is running in parallel and different than what the FDA is about and what the pharmaceutical industry is about as a mandate. You're about anti-aging. They're in the drug and disease business. You're in anti-aging and health, and it's different. And in a way, I could see how it would be perceived as being competitive to, or at cross purposes to, what they're about. I mean, it isn't, but I could see how it was perceived that way. I was delighted to see that tryptophan is back on the market and is doing well.
Yeah, it is. That was something that, contrary to, I think, what a lot of people believe, tryptophan was never banned, per se. There was an import restriction placed on it back in the 1990s because of some problems with a contaminated batch.
That happens with drugs, too.
Oh, absolutely.
All the time.
Absolutely. And yet somehow tryptophan was got this very bad reputation. But
do you take it?
I do not take tryptophan, but I know people who do, who have good results from it. particularly with sleep. That seems to be some people respond very, very well who don't sleep tremendously well, and taking some tryptophan in the evening, 500 milligrams to a gram, really seems to improve their quality of sleep.
Doesn't it up-level the amount of serotonin you have in your body, like the joy hormone or the joy chemical?
Yeah, serotonin, tryptophan is actually a precursor. It's the precursor amino acid, ultimately, to serotonin in the body. So you're right. L-tryptophan can help aid in serotonin metabolism. And there are some people, for a variety of reasons, that may not be getting enough L-tryptophan in the diet, although that's not typically most people get enough L-tryptophan in the diet. But for whatever reason, I mentioned earlier, when we first started talking, there does seem to be a fair amount of biochemical differences between all of us. And particularly in the area of nutritional supplements, what I've seen is that, for example, with L-tryptophan, some people take it and they swear it's the wonder nutrient, and they just feel so much better with it. Other people take it and they may not see much of an effect. So there's a great deal of individuality in terms of response.
Do you test for it? Can you actually test for your serotonin levels at the foundation?
There are tests. We offer so many tests, whether it's blood test panels for looking at hormones or looking at liver function, kidney function, cholesterol, lipid metabolism. And yes, as well, there are tests available, too, that can look at tryptophan levels. In plasma, there are some esoteric tests that can be done that can look at tryptophan metabolites as well. So there are a whole host of options for people if they're so inclined.
Do you take melatonin?
I typically do when I travel. If I travel, particularly any travel overseas, I find melatonin very helpful for resetting my body clock. So I certainly don't fly overseas without my melatonin.
I've been told that the pineal gland shrinks as we get older. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. The pineal gland does shrink a bit, and sometimes it'll even calcify as we get older. So, aging people typically have problems with sleep. One of the proposed reasons for that has been an alteration in melatonin metabolism. And we've seen many people taking a little melatonin at night, just sleeping much, much better. We also know that melatonin has health effects, health benefits. It's a pretty potent antioxidant. A lot of people are not aware of that.
I just learned that. I thought that was fascinating, that it is an antioxidant.
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful one, in fact, as well. And, yeah, I appreciate your comment. And a lot of people are not aware of that. But we've talked about the benefits of melatonin for many, many years. And, you know, all of the things we're talking about today, if people want to know more, learn more, all they need to do is go on our website, www.lef.org, and we have so much information. I believe at last count we have 40,000 individual web pages on our website.
That's amazing.
So if there's any health interest or topic that anyone wants to explore, chances are we have written about it, and if we haven't, and if you want us to write about it, just give us a call and let us know, and I'm sure we can do it.
I have one more comment about DHEA. This has been a hugely popular, I don't even know, like hormone that people took for many, many years. Then there was controversy about it, but now there's totally new science about it. Can you explain it?
Sure. Well, you'll have to tell me what new science you're alluding to.
Well, there's new information that women can take it, that there's even types of DHEA that doesn't convert to testosterone that women can take, that men are benefited by taking DHEA. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about it.
Sure. Our organization had highlighted the benefits of DHEA many, many years ago. DHEA has been known as the anti-aging hormone, and it is a hormone. What we know is that as people age, their levels of DHEA tend to decrease. There are very famous studies, that animal studies as well as human clinical studies, that have looked at the beneficial impact of supplementation with DHEA on the body. to the question you raised, which is, you know, that's one point in the past, there was controversy. We particularly didn't feel that way, but there was some controversy that taking DHEA may raise levels of either testosterone in the body or have other effects. And the very simple answer to this is, if anyone is concerned, if they take DHEA, all they have to do is get their hormone levels checked. Then they'll know exactly what's happening. But what we found in our experience is that women who take DHEA within an appropriate range, and our experience shows that women typically don't need as much DHEA as men. For many women, a dose of, for example, 15 milligrams of DHEA does just fine. For men tend to need a little bit more DHEA. Some men may need up to 50 milligrams of DHEA daily to get DHEA levels in the blood up to an optimal range. There's some great data, too, showing DHEA having beneficial effects on metabolism, and we know that metabolism tends to slow as we age. Another point that you raised, which is forms of DHEA, there are different forms. There's one form called 7-keto-DHEA, and that particular form of DHEA is an end molecule. What I mean by that is that it's not metabolized into other molecules. We also know that there's some very interesting data on 7-keto-DHEA, in particular on metabolism, and we've written about that in the past as well. So there are a whole variety of options depending upon what people's health goals are and their own individual needs. You know, I think the best thing to do, people have questions, talk to a qualified healthcare practitioner. You can always call up us at Life Extension. We have a whole group of health advisors that are available to provide counseling on health issues of interest, and our website as well. People can learn just so much just getting on our website. Also, our magazine. We're very proud of our magazine. Our magazine comes out every month. We highlight the latest advances in science, medicine, and nutrition. And I would say the best thing people can do if they really want to educate and learn more about translational medicine, integrative strategies to help them live healthier today, not tomorrow, today, read our magazine. Our magazine is copiously referenced. And if you have any questions, call us up. We'll be happy to talk to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have been speaking with Dr. Stephen Joyelle, the Vice President of Science and Medical Affairs for the Life Extension Foundation in Florida. And I want to invite all of you to join the foundation and to come back and learn more about life extension and anti-aging. And feel free to leave your comments at itsrainmakingtime.com. And also feel free to call the foundation. Dr. Joyelle, give the foundation's phone number, please.
Certainly. It is 1-800-226-2370. And, of course, it's 1-800. It's toll-free.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to It's Rainmaking Time. We welcome you back, and thank you for your time, Doctor.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure speaking
with you. It's a pleasure talking with you.